I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Donald Trump built his sprawling global businesses through real estate and property management deals and through branding his last name in big, bold letters. Now that he is president-elect, what is he going to do with those businesses to avoid conflicts of interest? Now, he said he put them in a blind trust run by his children, but most government ethicists say that does not meet the definition of a blind trust, especially since his children are part of the transition team and have sat in on meetings with business and world leaders. This week, he announced he was going to be the executive producer of the new Celebrity Apprentice on NBC, raising more concerns about the potential problems of mixing business with being president. And complicating matters, Donald Trump has not released his tax returns. Turns out there's no law that requires a president to divest him or herself of their business and financial holdings. Recent presidents have done it voluntarily. We have a couple of guests who have joined us on Radio Times to talk about all of this. Drew Harwell is business reporter for The Washington Post. And Drew, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Libby Nelson, politics and policy reporter for Vox. And Libby, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
Drew, let me begin with you, and let's start with what other presidents have done, realizing, of course, they don't have the kind of holdings that Donald Trump has had. But what have other presidents done with their money, their stocks, their bonds?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we've had presidents in the past who have had been rich and who have had money and assets and even business interests. And what they've done, even though there hasn't been any law saying that they need to do anything specifically like use a blind trust, they've all sort of followed a tradition that has said, we're going to sell our assets or we're going to liquidate them and put them into something called a blind trust where they don't really know what happens with them. They're sort of ruled by an independent overseer that they can't sway or influence or tell what to do. And that's a tradition that's been going back for the last 40 years or so. Pretty much every modern president has hewed to this under the feeling that not only is this better for the country because they can trust me a little bit and they can figure out that what I'm doing is for policy's sake and not necessarily for my own private business sake, but it's also good for the president because this is a vulnerability that they don't have to worry about.
Well, I'm thinking about Jimmy Carter. Now, he had a peanut farm. I'm trying to think if there are recent presidents who have had in any way the kind of business holdings, financial dealings that Donald Trump has had, Drew?
I mean, George Bush had some pretty considerable, you know, interest in Texas and energy, and he used a blind trust. And with Obama, you know, this is a case where this wasn't somebody who had a sprawling business, but he had assets. You know, he sort of had these, you know, treasuries that were very vanilla and wouldn't cause a problem at all, and he still sort of created a distance with him. He was even sort of afraid to refinance his home loan because he figured that would be sort of a potential – people could say, well, maybe you're treating this bank in a better way. So presidents have always really dealt with this with kid gloves. I mean, they felt like this is a potential huge issue that could explode with them. That's why it's so interesting that we have a president now who has the most assets we've seen of any president, and he's putting as little distance as possible, as we've seen, and it's really unprecedented.
Libby, there was supposed to be a meeting yesterday, or I guess a press conference yesterday, by Donald Trump to tell the public what he was going to do with his financial holdings. He decided, for whatever reason, to postpone that. What would you have wanted to know, or what would you have asked Donald Trump if given the chance?
Yeah, I mean, he had planned and announced that press conference well in advance and then canceled it pretty much at the last minute. But some of the key questions that remain are, he said he wants to turn his business over to his adult children, who are currently also on his transition committee. So whether his sons are playing a dual role is a key question. How he will ensure the separation between his businesses and his policies while he's in office is another thing he hasn't really spoken much about. There are a lot of unanswered questions here, and a press conference would have given us an opportunity to explore some of those.
Let me read a tweet that he sent out yesterday. This is Donald Trump. The media tries so hard to make my move to the White House as it pertains to my business so complex when actually it isn't. Is there any truth to that, Libby?
I mean, it's funny because the other excuse he has for not having fully explained what he's doing is that it is complex, and it is. He owns a lot of buildings. It's very different from just being rich and owning a lot of stock. But no, it certainly is. In one sense, it isn't all that complex. Selling it would be one solution, although a fairly complex one that he has not done. But his justification for why he hasn't spoken about this really seems to shift based on whatever his feelings of the day are.
Drew, what would you have wanted to have asked Donald Trump yesterday if he had had this news conference?
Yeah, I mean, those are the main questions. When he's talked about sort of giving it to his kids, the question has been, are you giving just sort of management, the kind of day-to-day operation of them sort of pushing the paper around and making those deals? Or are you really giving up the whole thing? Are you giving up your financial interest, the ownership of the thing? I think that's what's most important, and that's the part that Mr. Trump hasn't really said anything about. And we're sort of left to wonder, is he still going to have, you know, some skin in this game? And you know, if these businesses are, you know, performing out there and he has equity in those, he's going to want them to do fairly well, and that has, you know, financial strings into his own bank account. So is he just sort of giving the management to his kids, or is he really getting out of it entirely?
Well, it's interesting you say that. In preparation for the show, I was doing a lot of reading of what he has said or what he hasn't said about his business dealings, and it looks like the children would manage them as it stands now, but he would still retain control. If that's true, Drew, is that problematic?
I think it is problematic because, you know, the whole issue is control. Making the sort of day-to-day decisions, that's really less important for the financial sort of conflict of interest thing than control. And Trump has always had a really strong control on his companies. We see, I mean, that's why his name is on the building and no one else's. You know, this is a business interest that he really cares a lot about. And, you know, with the Trump Organization, which is sort of his private umbrella that he does pretty much everything with, he makes those decisions. It's his company, and a lot of the financial reward goes back to him. So, you know, if his kids were to sort of make the management decisions and he still had money coming back to him and still had the potential for sort of a back channel of influence for investors in that company or buyers of that company, that's still an issue.
Libby, he has said that he doesn't care about his businesses. He's not going to make any new deals. Again, does that get closer to dealing with the potential conflicts of interest?
In some ways, I think it actually makes them worse because when he says he's not going to do any new deals, it seems in a way that he's reassuring his business partners and the people with an interest in the company that things are not going to get out of control while he's in office. But it also means that it really lowers the possibility that he won't know anything that's going on with his company. He knows right now where his business interests are. And what he, in effect, has said is that that's going to remain static for the next 4 or 8 years.
I mentioned this in the introduction, but I think it is a complicating factor, which is since he has not released his tax returns, we don't really know much about where and how he makes his money. I mean, he makes apparently a lot of money, Libby, but it feels as if we're a little bit operating in the dark here.
Yeah, it's really very difficult to find out much of anything about his businesses because of the way he structures them. So if you look at the lease on the old post office hotel in D.C., for example, that is technically signed by a corporation that is then made up of other corporations in his name, in his children's names, and they're all registered anonymously in Delaware. And basically all of his business empire is like this, where you can sort of guess based on the names you know, who might own something or what it might exist to do. But we're essentially looking at them and saying, oh, you know, he had something called Trump Drinks Israel. That must mean he's doing business in Israel. And that's sort of the status of the transparency that exists right now.
Well, Drew, let's talk a little bit about this Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., newly opened. Now, this is in an old post office, so it's a hotel that is leased by the federal government. This, of course, gets complicated. Once he becomes president, can he retain whatever control or ownership of that hotel?
That's the big question. That's sort of what the government is still sort of deliberating on. We've been asking the Office of Government Ethics and the Government Service Administration, all these agencies that would rule on this sort of thing, and they're almost as flummoxed as everybody else. Some people say that the day he steps into the Oval Office, January 20th, he's going to be violating that clause because there's a few things that pertain to this. One is the actual lease where, you know, the old post office office is government run. The Trump Organization has a lease on the building, so they can run it as a hotel, even though it's still owned by we, the taxpayer. There's something in the lease that says a government official can't profit or have any sort of benefit from that relationship. So does it count even if Trump sealed that lease a couple years ago before he was running for the presidency? Or is it different because he is the president and he exerts a wide amount of influence on this project? I mean, just imagine, after January 20th, if the Trump company wants to renegotiate the lease with the government holders who manage the lease, imagine being that government official who has to negotiate with the son of the president or the president himself. I mean, that's a huge conflict right there. And that has the potential to, hurt the financial deal that the taxpayer has. That's the real big question, and it could be something we're dealing with for the next 4 years.
Well, Libby, I'm also thinking about someone that might book some rooms at the hotel or book a meeting at the hotel. Does that raise conflicts of interest?
I mean, the whole if you want to sort of understand what the big issues are around Trump's conflicts of interest, the hotel is a really great place to start because it embodies so many of them. So there's this issue with the GSA, which he will appoint the next head of and which is leasing him the building. There's the fact that already the hotel has promoted itself to diplomats, as the Post reported, as a way to it's a thing that all luxury hotels in D.C. do on the one hand, but on the other, you have the opportunity to literally put money in the pocket of the future president. So that's certainly a concern. It certainly does provide, at the very least, a huge appearance of conflict of interest if you have foreign governments or domestic lobbying groups literally directly giving money to the president's business while trying to influence his policy.
Can anyone force him to sell whatever ownership Libby has in this hotel?
That's a huge question that Congress is trying to deal with. There was sort of a fracas this week about whether he is already in breach of the lease, will be in breach of the lease as soon as he takes office. What we're finding with a lot of these conflict of interest issues is it's fairly hard to force the president to do anything. And that's one thing that Trump says over and over and over again is, this is legal, but I'm going to try and step back from my businesses anyway, because a lot of conflict of interest laws don't apply. There is a constitutional issue at hand that forbids you. It's called the Emoluments Clause, and it forbids you from getting income from foreign governments or foreign leaders or titles or other things like that. The question really is who's going to have the standing to challenge Trump on that and whether the hotel would be considered to be part, to be in violation of that part of the Constitution.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Libby Nelson. She's politics and policy reporter for Vox, joining us along with Drew Harwell, who's business reporter for The Washington Post, actually joining us from the studios of The Washington Post. And we are talking about some of the questions raised about Donald Trump's businesses and what happens to those businesses when he is sworn in as president of the United States. We want to know what you think. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about questions surrounding President-elect Donald Trump's potential conflicts of interest between serving the country as president and serving his businesses. Let me get a third guest in on the conversation. Danielle Bryan is executive director of the Project on Government Oversight. And Danielle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. So why do the conflict of interest rules that apply to many government and perhaps most government employees not apply to the president of the United States?
Well, that sentence sort of has two parts. The first part is there is a rule for all government employees that prevents conflicts of interest, but it does explicitly not apply to the president and the vice president. So it is essentially everyone else. But there's a lot of legal theory that, in fact, the reason it doesn't apply to them is more about a separation of powers than it is that it shouldn't apply. And what we've learned from the Office of Government Ethics is that every previous president has, in fact, honored the spirit of that rule and has gone ahead and put all of their assets into some sort of blind trust so they don't have the conflict of interest.
Can the Office of Government Ethics force Donald Trump to put his holdings into a true blind trust?
No one can force the president to do that. He has to make that choice himself. And so that is essentially what we are arguing, is the president has, or the president-elect has recognized that there is a visual conflict and that he needs to handle it. And we believe that's really the only way for him to be able to do that is to follow that lead that, that presidents of both parties have previously done. He's not the first president of wealth who's had to manage this.
Let me go back to that tweet that you just quoted. This is from November 30th, and this is part of his tweet. While I'm not mandated to do this under the law, I feel it is visually important as president to in no way have a conflict of interest with my various businesses. In order, Danielle, to be true to that tweet, what would he have to do?
He would have to appoint someone who is a third party, that means not his children, who would then take over the handling of all of his assets. That doesn't mean he has to immediately, Trump has to immediately sell all of his assets. It means he's putting it in the hand of someone else who will manage that, and then Trump will not actually know when and what is happening. And that is something that, as I said, has been done by both Presidents Bush. Even Jimmy Carter sold, put a blind trust his peanut farm. And President Reagan did the same thing as well. There's one more thing I want to note, though. That is the one law that we're talking about that doesn't apply to the president. However, the Constitution does apply to the president.
Right.
And the Constitution very clearly states that the president cannot be doing business with foreign entities. And that's sort of, in our mind, one of the more central issues. This isn't a question of whether he chooses to apply the Constitution to himself. He has to.
And that's that emoluments clause that we've been learning about, right?
Exactly. It's a word that few of us knew a month ago.
But a very important word. Libby, I know that you at Vox have been looking at Donald Trump's various foreign business dealings and holdings. They're pretty complex, and they pretty much cover a lot of the world.
Yeah, they do. And one thing that's key to understand about these is that when Trump is doing business abroad, often he is not building or, operating the hotel in the way that he is in Washington, D.C. He is essentially letting people use the Trump name through these licensing agreements, which can make it in some ways even more difficult to ascertain what's actually going on and what, what the status of a project is. But he has projects that we know of in India. He has one in Brazil that I believe was just suspended. He has a project in Argentina. He has registered corporations in Saudi Arabia or had in the past, and has also working on, I believe, a golf course in the United Arab Emirates. So he really has a lot of dealings around the world. There are his golf courses in Scotland, of course, and some projects in Ireland that span from countries we think of as allies to countries that the U.S. has a more complex relationship with. And all of those are obviously nations he will be dealing with as president.
Drew, I'm thinking about licensing agreements in particular. Do you think, raise some ethical questions for a President Trump?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, these are really lucrative agreements for him. These are the sort of things where a developer from another country will pay him a couple million dollars just for the privilege of sort of putting the Trump name on the building and kind of create a management contract there. But that's a revenue stream for the company that's pretty vital, and they really don't have to do that much. They don't have to invest their own money. That's money in their pocket. This has connected Trump to some moguls across the world who have their own sort of weird relationships. He's had projects in places like Azerbaijan that are sort of run by long-running regimes that have been accused of corruption and human rights abuse. He's shaking hands with a lot of billionaires and, rulers of empires across the world that the country may have some diplomatic, ties with, maybe have some sensitive sort of financial ties with. How is that going to steer his relationship? I mean, if this is if this is a lucrative deal that is giving him several million dollars, but the country, you know, our diplomats here want to, you know, crack down on them, is Mr. Trump going to independently rule that that's the right thing to do for the country, or is he going to step back? I mean, this is the speculation, but this is the issue that, you know, it seems subtle, but this is a thing that could really affect our foreign policy, our labor policy, all these sorts of things that are very disconnected from his private empire.
Danielle, going back to you, is there something that Congress could do to force, if I can use that word, force President Trump to be more transparent about his business dealings?
Well, the Congress can't force the president to be more transparent. The Congress does have the power, though, if persuaded that they believe he may have violated the Constitution. They are the one entity that has the power to initiate impeachment hearings. So that is, you know, that is ultimately sort of the nuclear weapon to protect the Constitution and prevent something terrible from happening. I think it's also important when, as your other guests are pointing out, this concept of his being able to continue his business, to be able to continue to have business dealings abroad, is essentially sort of corruption 101 across sort of the history of foreign relations. This is exactly what we have seen historically, where foreign governments can give favors to princelings in other countries to get their own favors returned. So the idea that the president, even if, as he's currently saying, president-elect, is turning these business dealings over to his children,
right,
that is in no way making things better. That's sort of like a playbook for how you have historically have had corruption across the world.
Donald Trump has said many things about his business dealings. This is from November 22nd. He said, the law's totally on my side, meaning the president can't have a conflict of interest. Sounds a little Nixonian, but I'm also wondering to all of you, but to you, Danielle, if there's some truth to that.
There's absolutely not truth to that. As we've mentioned, the Constitution is the highest form of law, and it is very clear. There is just, you know, this is a black and white question. He is hanging his hat on the provision, it's called Provision 208, which says that government employees can't receive external funds beyond their government pay. But the Constitution absolutely does apply to him, along with other things like bribery statutes. So the idea that he's taking this one statute that doesn't apply to him and saying no statutes do is just absolutely false.
Drew, you want to add to that? And then to you, Libby. And then we'll get some callers in. Drew?
Yeah, I think she's totally right. And, you know, a conflict of interest is not necessarily just a law. It's a concept. It's a truth of running and politics, running a government. I mean, these are things that, you know, there are bribery statutes, fraud, corruption, and really there's just public opinion. I mean, are people going to trust what he says is the right thing if he's got all of these entanglements that are potentially steering him other ways? So, yeah, there are such a thing as a conflict of interest for the president, and I think we're already starting to see him now.
Libby?
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that is the thing that really is at stake here is confidence and trust in his administration and its ability to put the interest of Americans first. I mean, if you think back to the campaign and the Clinton Foundation scandal and how much attention and worry was expended on the appearance of a quid pro quo, even though there was really no evidence that there was any quo in exchange for the quids, like that's what we're talking about on a much more massive level. We've never had to ask in this sort of frame before, is the president going to make a decision based on his ideology and what he thinks is best for the American people, or is he going to make a decision based on what will not just, you know, benefit him, but benefit him financially and benefit his businesses?
Libby, let me ask you, I mean, do you think that Donald Trump gets it? And the reason I put it that way is that there were his children meeting with tech leaders a couple of days ago, that we know that the children have also been at meetings involving some foreign leaders and other business leaders as well. Does he get that looks like a conflict of interest?
You know, he doesn't, and I really don't believe that he does. And I think the question is whether he doesn't want to get it or whether he just simply does not understand the issue as such. I think a generous way to look at it would be that he is someone with no background in government, no background in public service. And so when he's dealing with this issue, what we've seen is he deals with it like a CEO. He deals with the issue of, you know, what's it going to, quote unquote, look like, or what is it going to be visually bad. He has sort of dealt with the question of what will happen to his businesses in terms of will his kids be empowered to make deals for him while his adult sons are running the company. But he really doesn't seem to understand the gravity of the situation, or is at the very least continuing to downplay it, perhaps because he ran on his business expertise and the idea that, you know, that's what you're elected for and now you have to give it up. Perhaps to him that's a strange concept.
What do you think, Danielle?
Well, the one thing I would agree, except that I am seeing, we are seeing sort of an evolution of his position. You know, the point you were making where you said conflicts don't apply to me has clearly evolved since then. So I do think that public outcry, media coverage, is clearly, maybe because he's a businessman and he cares about his brand, is clearly having an impact on the positions he's taking. So we're seeing sort of a whittling away on his theory that conflicts don't apply to him.
You want to weigh in on this, Drew?
Yeah, I'll say I think he is evolving a little bit. You know, a couple of weeks ago when he said conflicts were visually important, that sort of stuck out to me as, you know, this isn't something that's visually important. This is just regular old important. This is the running of the country. But now that, you know, we're starting to see him back away a little bit, even though we see the kids in the tech meeting, and that's still a huge no-no. I mean, there are sort of suggestions that, you know, even this week the lawyer at his company I talked to yesterday, they say they've dissolved a couple of these sort of more problematic kind of foreign deals, maybe because they feel like the money isn't worth the headache. And you know, I think that's maybe a baby step, but it's still sort of a step in the right direction. He's recognizing, you know, this is something that's this is clouding my run already. This is something people are jamming the phone lines of Democratic Congress people. And maybe I don't really want to – maybe it's not worth it. I mean, even the amount of ducats that are going to my company aren't worth the lack of trust. So I think when we hear more details, hopefully next month, on what he wants to do for his future plan, that's, I think, when we'll get our future sort of encouragement or discouragement about what he's going to do. But I think he is sort of starting to evolve on this, and hopefully he has people in his ears telling him what to do.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. What should President-elect Donald Trump do with his sprawling business empire? We've got Dan from, looks like, Winmore joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a couple comments, then a suggestion. One of the comments has to do with Trump supposedly saying he'll take a dollar salary. I think he needs to take his entire salary. We're going to pay him to do the job. Get in there. This is the job you do, and don't have any distractions. $400,000 to the president is a small amount to pay to make, in the grand scheme of the country, to make someone do the job they were elected for. Second, if there's separation of powers and you cannot force the president or vice president to divest because of conflicts of interest, it would seem the whole executive branch, by that same theory, would be exempt because there's separation of powers between Congress and the executive. So I wonder, sure, how come just the president and vice president are exempt? Third, with him saying, I'm not required, look at the brouhaha that arose with Al Gore over a slight question of misfeasance when he said there was no controlling legal authority. People went wild over maybe the language, maybe the idea that someone was exempt from this. But I think short of impeaching someone for not doing the job or, I mean, having high crimes and misdemeanors, Congress has the power of the purse. I think they could say we're defunding certain things, executive branch or agencies under the executive branch, until you come into compliance. Now, what happens if
We're almost up on the clock here. You put a couple of things on the table, and I want to make sure before we say goodbye to Danielle, give her a chance to respond to some really interesting points there. One about if it's the separation of powers, then why not the whole executive branch and not just the president and vice president that have these special rules?
I think that's an excellent question, and it's something I'm going to go back to ask attorneys myself, actually. But I
Great.
Think that off the top of my head, I think it must be because the question of the president has executive privileges that apply to his office. But that has been the explanation that I've been given. But thank you for asking that, because it's a question I need to know how to answer better.
Yeah, it's a great question. Dan, I'm sorry to do that to you. What about the power of the purse, Danielle? Is it possible for Congress to say, well, we're not going to pay the heating bill for the White House to get you to...
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's certainly possible. That is, you know, that is the theory of the Constitution, is that the Congress is the most powerful branch of government. It hasn't been operating that way in a while, but they theoretically could do that as well.
And what about the tax returns? Is there any constitutional reason, Danielle, that the public should have access to Donald Trump's tax returns?
Unfortunately, that's one of these things that has been just a standard practice, but not something that's required by law. And so there is nothing that we can hang our hat on in saying that this is a violation of anything.
And the fact that he wants to be executive producer of the new Celebrity Apprentice on NBC, does that raise any questions for you?
Well, other than it being unseemly, it is, I am, again, maybe I'm overly optimistic, but there has been such an outcry over that it's hard to believe that that's actually going to continue to happen.
What do you think, Libby?
I think, first of all, the conflict with Celebrity Apprentice is not so much that being a producer is requiring work or will generate significant income in any different way from book royalties. But on the other hand, the government regulates NBC through the FCC and through other agencies. It's also a huge conflict for NBC, which now essentially has the president on its payroll. I am a little bit less optimistic, I would say, about the power of an outcry to change the president-elect's behavior. I think that is something that happened irregularly, if at all, during the campaign, and he is as likely to adjust his positions and actions as he is to say, well, it's been working for me so far. I don't care what you think. I'm just going to keep doing it.
Well, we're Go ahead, Danielle.
I would say that the more immediate conflict that I think is the big challenge is the fact that he has a lease with the government for his hotel in Washington, where it's very clearly a violation. And I think that's where we're going to hopefully see some direct action over that issue.
Well, Danielle, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Danielle Bryan, Executive Director of the Project on Government Oversight. Libby Nelson, Politics and Policy Reporter for Vox. And Drew Harwell, Business Reporter for The Washington Post, staying with us for the rest of the hour. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. A few weeks ago, Donald Trump tweeted that he would be holding a major news conference on December 15th, yesterday, about how to avoid conflicts of interest with his various businesses. A Trump spokesman earlier this week said they needed more time. Donald Trump has made money from real estate and property management deals and through branding his last name. The Office of Government Ethics has advised Trump's lawyer to sell the businesses to avoid possible investigations and the appearance of using the presidency to benefit himself and his family. Drew Harwell, business reporter for The Washington Post, and Libby Nelson, politics and policy reporter for Vox, our guests as we close out this hour. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Drew, let me go to you and actually go to one of the Trump hotels, the one in Las Vegas. There are some union squabbles going on there, which could involve, or perhaps maybe already do involve, the National Labor Relations Board. What questions does that raise for you for a President Trump?
In that case, you know, Trump has a half stake in a nice hotel on the Las Vegas Strip. There have been a number of people who work there who were trying to unionize and sort of fighting the company tooth and nail for a long time. And Trump was putting up quite the fight, too. That's sort of how the case went to the National Labor Relations Board. Trump actually lost before that board. It's sort of like a court that hears kind of unionization issues. And it was great for the workers that I've talked to who have said, you know, this was a fight we were doing against a big company guy for a long time, and we finally won. We can finally unionize and get better hours, get better pay and insurance, that sort of thing. So they were fighting against a big company. Now they're going to be fighting against the president because the Trump company is still sort of appealing that case. You know, they lost in the National Labor Relations Board. The next step is sort of the D.C. Circuit Court and then even potentially the Supreme Court. And, of course, the National Labor Relations Board, if they go against Trump's company, that's going to be effectively Trump versus Trump because he, as president, will appoint the people who are above the Department of Justice who will defend the National Labor Relations Board. So it just gets really messy really quick. And you can imagine how sort of daunting it can be to be one of these laborers at one of the hotels who, you know, is just cleaning a room 10 hours a day and wants better pay. And it was hard enough fighting a company and now going against, you know, sort of the commander in chief. And that's not just for those people at that one hotel. I mean, Trump is going to be effectively setting labor policy for lots of different companies all across the country. So, you know, and we've seen that with his secretary of labor pick who you know, is the owner of Carl's Jr. and Hardee's, right, and has been sort of down on expanding overtime rules and these sorts of labor friendly practices. So, you know, here's an instance where there's a direct connection between the president's thoughts and the president's business connection. And you know, is he really going to think in the way of how American laborers want, sort of think independently, or is he going to think, well, what would be better for my business?
Libby, it's a kind of a David Goliath situation there. You want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And it's the case in a lot of these situations is that basically what you end up with is the president is someone with tremendous power. And even when he is entangled with essentially his own government, which is something we see with the D.C. hotel, for example, if they decide he is in breach of the lease, it is going to be a fairly low level civil servant who has to sort of start proceeding against him. Beyond sort of the weirdness of the fact that he is their ultimate boss, it does really tip the scales in terms of the power imbalance in a lot of these situations, even more so than it already would be tipped.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from a listener saying no one cares about what we're talking about. Another a comment from David: Trump is either corrupt or clueless. An email from Peter: the excuse for not revealing returns is that he was under audit. He never responded. Has he been pressed on it? How to trust him when we don't know what to trust him about? Let me go back to both to you, Libby, and to you, Drew. The fact that we haven't seen his tax returns, I realize he doesn't have to, but it is kind of unprecedented for modern presidents to be so withholding. Libby, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, it's absolutely unprecedented. He has made the routine financial disclosure that he is required to make, and that is why we really know any of this that we're able to talk about. That includes a lot of similar information, but not nearly the breadth of what you would get from a tax return. And even that disclosure, the next one he has to make will not, by law, be until May of 2018. And so that question of when he should be trusted, to me, the thing that really exemplified that was a couple of weeks ago in the middle of the discussions about the Carrier air conditioning company and the Dakota Access Pipeline. His spokesman kind of suddenly announced that, oh, by the way, Trump had sold all of his stock back in June or July, right, and in publicly traded companies, and we're just hearing about it now. There are, I think, some reasons to be skeptical of that, given how many hits he's taken for conflicts of interest. It seems odd that he never mentioned it before. But we won't be able to verify that unless he really changes his ways until the next legally mandated financial disclosure in 2018.
You're suspicious of that, Libby?
I'm a little bit suspicious. I think he'd come under so much criticism for his conflicts of interest and for stock he owned already. It just seemed very odd to say without documentation, oh, by the way, he got rid of all that 6 months ago. There certainly would have been moments when it would have been politically advantageous for him to point that out in the past. It doesn't mean it's not true. I just think it is something that as a country, as consumers and of news and journalists, that we should approach with appropriate amounts of skepticism.
What do you think, Drew?
I agree with the skepticism. I'll sort of posit a separate theory that's just as unverifiable as that one, because the Trump folks won't really give us that much. But, you know, the Trump spokesman said he sold all of his stock portfolio in June. In June was a really important time for his campaign. He was finding that campaigns are very expensive. He had loaned his campaign a lot of money. And in June, he sort of forgave that loan and started funneling even more money into the campaign. So Trump needed money, effectively. And if he were to say that he sold all of his stocks, you know, liquidating your assets is not something that a verified, bona fide billionaire does. And so maybe he thought, you know, I don't necessarily want to come from this position of weakness and saying that I need the ducats and that's why I'm going to sell all my stocks. So I could understand why he would be quiet about something like that. Of course, that's just a theory. And the real truth of it is that they haven't given us proof either way, no matter how many times we've asked for evidence of this very, very big conflict. And that just goes back to the even broader issue that the level of transparency with the Trump folks and his finances has just been so low. Such opaque, you know, details about his business. I think people would be surprised about how little we know about his businesses because Mr. Trump, in a way that a lot of executives do it, uses pretty much every trick in the book to share as little information as possible about the more than 500 companies that we know he's a part of, the many deals he's a part of. And tax returns are one of them. And you know, the reader, the listener who said, I don't think anybody cares about this, I think, you know, that person is probably sort of more right than we would expect. But, you know, and that's mainly a function of how we talk about these things. When we say tax returns, that sounds like a really boring concept, but there's so much information in there. You know, it's not just tax rate. It's foreign accounts. It's partners in places like Russia that would be nice to know what the president-elect has to do. It's wealth. It's wages. It's, you know, all of these important things that say not just how Trump is as a business person, but how he's going to be as an independent sort of leader of the country.
Let me get Lev from Newtown to join our conversation. Hi, Lev. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening intently. So I don't know if my question is asked in the right setting, but question is, don't you think all the Trump assets and Trump-labeled businesses basically become targets for terrorism, international, domestic? You know, if you want to press somebody into, well, stand against something, some kind of deal, you can always sort of hurt the business, so to speak. Hotels, you know, hotels come to mind. Hotels are frequent targets. And he has hotels in many different hot areas of the world. So
that's really interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Libby, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a great point, and is one of the many concerns about these many foreign assets he has. As you said, obviously, you know, hotels have been targets in the past. A hotel with the president-elect of the United States name on it, I can imagine being, if you wanted to make a statement. But I would take that, you know, a little bit farther down this road and say, in that case, you know, do we have an increased security budget for essentially the president's assets or assets bearing the president's name? Like, it's not only the possible security threat, but the ways that this could distort foreign policy, security policy, and the way the government looks at threats in a way that it simply wouldn't happen if, you know, Obama doesn't have his name on buildings in the Philippines.
Drew, you were talking about Donald Trump's tax returns. An email from Betsy. She says, must not Trump's taxes be released so investigators can see how he might have been financially tied to Russia in order to understand any connections? Otherwise, it would be an incomplete investigation. As we know, the president has called for an investigation to look and see just how much involvement the Russian government or Russians had in our election process. Again, I guess we're back to this question about can he be forced to release that information under some kind of investigation?
As far as we know, no. Right now, there's no law that says he has to. There was certainly no law that said he had to release his tax returns as a private citizen. And now, as a president, there's nothing forcing him. But they're very important, and they're so important that, you know, Mr. Trump asked Mike Pence for his tax returns, that a lot of the people going into Trump's cabinet and even the sort of lower servants below those appointees in the cabinet have to give their tax returns because the government realizes, hey, this is important information to know. So, you know, why don't we have the presidents? I mean, that's the big question. And a lot of Democratic members of Congress have urged, you know, to create a law, if not to force Trump to right now, but to at least establish some precedent in the future that this isn't something we're squabbling about, that this really important piece of information that the IRS already has, that's already sort of floating around Washington, that we can't really act on in this really important way. way. But, you know, I think the thing that's going to force him, not necessarily any law on the book right now, the Republicans in Congress, if they feel like this is an important issue and they want to push it, they could. I don't think we've seen a lot of momentum from them that could certainly change. And there are already some Republicans in Congress who are pushing back on this. But how much are they going to tolerate? How much sort of transparency are they going to call for? And you know, not just their fellow party official colleague, I guess, but the president. I mean, this is information that's important for the State Department people who are working with Russia and for all of us here who are looking at an antagonist across the Atlantic Ocean and wondering how deep the connection is between the president and them.
Libby, you mentioned a couple of the countries that Donald Trump has done business with. He received a phone call from the president of Argentina shortly after winning the election. We know he's got these golf courses in Scotland. He opposed some wind farms that would have been off the Scottish coast. He apparently talked to Nigel Farage about that. Can you put some more flesh on those bones?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly has had a lot of conversations with foreign leaders, as all newly elected presidents do. But certainly one thing that stands out about them, beyond the conversation he had with Nigel Farage, which is, it kind of sounds silly because wind farms are sort of wind farms and golf courses don't seem like the most serious issues, but was really unprecedented to sort of bring up this issue confronting his business. The other thing is that his daughter Ivanka has been on at least a handful of these calls. And that, I think, to me, speaks to Trump's willingness to mix family and business and politics in this way that we really haven't seen before and that clearly the laws of the United States don't quite know how to deal with.
Let me get looks like Bob from Swarthmore to join us. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Morning.
My question is whether or not Donald Trump is capable of taking the oath of office under all these circumstances. Is there any grounds for Justice Roberts to refuse to administer the oath?
Well, Bob, we should add to that the Electoral College is meeting on Monday. Drew, I'm assuming that they will reinforce the fact that he won the Electoral College vote in November. Are there any options that you know of?
I think the biggest option that sticks out to me, and you know, anybody can sue anybody, and it's sort of a question of what the standing is. But Trump has lots of businesses out there. He has lots of business ties. I think this will be something we'll be seeing in the courts a lot. But I think the biggest, and this goes straight to the heart of it, is the threat of impeachment that goes along with that thing called the Emoluments Clause that we've talked about. That is no foreign gifts or payments from to one of our public officials. If a diplomat stays at the lovely Trump Hotel in D.C. and pays double market rate, is that a potential gift? And if so, is that something that's due to threat of impeachment? Remember with Nixon, I mean, impeachment was a bipartisan affair. That was something that Republicans and Democrats were both incensed by. Could that be the same thing we see here? So, you know, I don't know if anything will happen between now and January 20th that could change it. But this is something, as long as Trump keeps this vulnerability open, people, his, you know, Democrats and his other opponents, even in the Republican Party, are going to target it. And so if he really wanted to close off this really defenseless part of his pedigree, you know, he would step back or he could threaten, you know, he could face this for the next 4 years.
Libby, 20 seconds on giving you the last word. Any final thoughts?
The only thing I would add to that is, for all of the theories about the Electoral College, I think Donald Trump absolutely is going to be the president. And as far as Congress holding him accountable, it's worth remembering that Watergate happened at the low ebb of partisanship and polarization in Congress. We're in a very different environment today.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Libby Nelson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Politics and policy reporter for Vox, Drew Harwell, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Business reporter for The Washington Post, joining us from the studios of The Washington Post. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.